Welcome back to Spellbound. I'm Julian Smith.
I'm Andrew Reeder.
Today we are here talking about Andrew's book, Beyond the Known. This is a part two, so if you're just tuning in on this, highly recommend you start with part one. We did that, I guess, 2 or 3 weeks ago. I can't remember off the top of my head, but that would be a great place to start because we're kind of walking through the book in chronological order. So part one was like the first half of the book, and part two is now I'm just wasting my time explaining it. And first of all, I just want to say, Andrew, I was reading the article that you did in the Global Mail. I guess that was that this week or last week? When did you do this? November 29th,
Global Mail, yeah, 2 days ago. Yeah.
Okay. And
it was Black Friday it came out, actually, I think.
Yeah. Anyways, I was just reading this article that you wrote on exploration and in Canada and how America kind of took all the credit for the Canadian exploration and stuff. It's just like, it just gave me a newfound appreciation for why you're so bad at taking compliments. It's because you're Canadian.
Well, there's one thing that Canadians love. It's comparing themselves to America and pretending they're better. So I figured it would go off well in Canada. It was the top article in the Globe and Mail, which is the biggest newspaper in Canada for the day. And it got hundreds of comments, I think, and all really positive, saying, oh, yeah, Canada's awesome. I mean, Canadians are kind of like the same as Americans, except we like to think of ourselves as better.
So, and more modest at the same time.
And more modest. Yeah, that's one of the ways in which we're better, is we're more modest.
But I just, you know, without spending too much time talking about the article, because it's not too related, but it's also not unrelated because your book is about exploration and so is your article in the Global Mail. Or is it the Globe and Mail? I'm looking at it now.
It's Globe and Mail, yeah.
Okay, yeah, Globe and I'm Mail. Mispronouncing it. Anyways, you were just talking about how America is like all about taking credit for being these like exploration pioneers when the feats that they accomplished were like half as impressive as what Canada did. And nobody knows about the Canadian feats because they're just too modest. And I was like, this is Andrew.
Kind of true. Like Lewis and Clark. So everyone knows the great American explorers, Lewis and Clark, who went across the continent in like 1805. What people don't generally know is that there was a Canadian, actually Scottish, because Canada didn't exist at the time, but, you know, basically he lived in Canada for a long time. We consider him to be Canadian, who, with the aid of some indigenous guides, just like Lewis and Clark, went across the continent not once, but twice along a longer, more difficult route 12 years earlier. So this has already been done.
Basically, he called it Disappointment River because it didn't lead to the Pacific. Is this that guy?
Yeah. He called the river he followed Disappointment River because the first one he went along led to the Arctic, and it's now called Mackenzie River, even though he called it Disappointment River. So they renamed it after him, even though he didn't like it. It's kind of funny.
Poor guy.
And it's the third longest river in North America after the Mississippi and the Missouri, which are the two longest. Yeah.
Wow.
So yeah, and there's all these other examples, like Charles Lindbergh. Everyone knows about him, but actually, the first people to cross the Atlantic in an airplane did it 10 years before that and landed in Canada. Right?
Were they Canadian though?
They were not Canadian. They were British.
Okay.
Part of the British Empire.
The Brits get that one.
So you know, but still, yeah.
It's kind of Canada's win.
But vast tracts of the United States, almost, in fact, the vast majority of the United States was surveyed, was explored by not Americans, but actually Canadians, people from Canada who came, the French who came down the Ohio Valley and the Mississippi. I mean, this is why we have St. Louis, Missouri, St. Louis, after the French king, and you have New Orleans being French. You have all these places. So much of the United States was actually surveyed by French explorers, including a French Canadian who was actually born in Canada named Joliet. In fact, I'm sure you've probably heard of the town of Joliet, Illinois, which is a suburb of Chicago.
I haven't, but I take your word for it.
Oh, okay.
You're very rarely incorrect.
Maybe people haven't, yeah. So and even the West, like seeing the Rockies, there was this French-Canadian explorer who 70 years before Lewis and Clark actually reached the Rockies.
Wow.
And he explored the Dakotas, basically. So even out west, like the Great Plains, the Dakotas. I mean, it's kind of telling because when Lewis and Clark crossed the continent, they met not only Sacagawea, who was Native American, but her husband was French. They meant a European along the way who had already kind of explored the area. So they were just kind of like finding out, trying to find out what other people already knew. It's not that they were kind of discovering this stuff. I mean, obviously the whole sort of conceit of European exploration is a bit strange because there were already people living there, right? Like all the lands that Lewis and Clark passed through were already inhabited by Native Americans, of course. And 90% of the lands they passed through had already been explored by earlier European explorers, mainly the French.
Well, now French you're Canadians. Starting to blow this whole Canadians are modest thing out of the water.
Well, if you start picking at that,
you brag one more time, I'm going to call your bluff.
Well, this is the thing. We just don't go around like shouting it all the time, advertising it all the time, right?
No, it's totally true. It's totally true. I'm just giving you a hard time.
But this is actually like a funny rivalry, this international rivalry between Canada and the United States. It's mirrored in so many other countries, pairs of countries. So Canada has 1/10 the population of the United States. United States is, Canada has a smaller population than California. So Americans barely notice that Canada exists. But to Canadians, the United States is this overwhelming cultural black hole, right? It's just, you can't not notice it. Like, basically, American news has almost no Canadian content whatsoever, but Canadian news has tons and tons of American content. It's like half American content. TV shows in Canada. There are some Canadian TV shows, but the vast majority are produced in the United States, right? And so this kind of rivalry between these countries of disparaging size is played out other places like the Netherlands and Belgium, and Australia and New Zealand is a good example where they're kind of similar to outsiders. They seem kind of similar, but then they have this intense rivalry between each other.
Yeah.
But one side has a rivalry more than the other. Like with Australia, they barely notice that New Zealand exists. But with New Zealand, it's their like overlying obsession.
It's so
to
true.
Think they're better than Australia. In fact, they have all, you walk through like New Zealand, the stores,
I object.
And they, all the t-shirts
Kiwis,
are like...
Kiwis think they're better than everybody.
Well, they are kind of though.
They kind of are. I still think the Nordics take that one.
I think it was voted the sexiest accent, right? New Zealand?
That's is it?
Yeah.
It is a good one.
And when they count numbers, they say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Sex. Right.
Yeah.
Of course they do. Of course they do. It is an interesting art. It's an interesting idea, though. The idea that America takes too much credit. And like maybe that idea put them on the map in a way. You know, maybe their audacity, like the audacious culture, like, is responsible for half of their achievements because like people just started associating America with like these great feats, even though they half of them had already been accomplished by other people before, like you're saying, you know, like maybe I'm not saying it's right or that people should take credit for things that aren't theirs, obviously, but it is interesting. It's like how much of America's prestige internationally is like bogus.
Well, yeah, it's true. I mean, it's a mix. And obviously, America is a very inventive place. Lots of things were invented here, like the airplane. But even the airplane, there was a German named Otto Lilienthal who invented like 90% of the airplane, basically all the wings and stuff like that. It was a glider. But what the Wright brothers did was combine it with an engine that was reliable enough to power an airplane. So other people sort of somewhat invented the airplane before, and they just stuck an engine on it, basically. So even that, but there's a lot of examples like that. Steam engine, that was really invented by the Scots. Actually, you could argue that per capita, the Scots have been one of the most inventive peoples and economics, like Adam Smith. Huh. And there's a book, in fact, saying like how Scotland invented the world or something like that.
China and then Scotland, probably.
Yeah, well, China has historically probably the most inventions, as we discussed last time. But they didn't really perfect them very well. Like they just kind of invented stuff and then other people took them and... perfected them.
Kind of sounds like everything made in China.
Well, it's because of the incentive structure of the Chinese Empire was really
bureaucratic. Talked about this. I think that's right.
We talked about this. Yeah. I mean, it was a top-down imperial system with consolidated power in the hands of the mandarins. Mandarin actually just means like the court bureaucrats. That's what the name for the language comes from. And they
I thought it meant
wanted
oranges.
To maintain control, so they didn't want change, basically.
Makes sense.
Yeah, oranges too.
Yeah. All right, let's dive into your book because we're about 10 minutes in now. And we haven't even talked about it. We've talked about a lot of other exploration, but we need to get through your book. And on that note, I have not. I'm still only about 2/3 of the way through. So let's consider this part two, as if you were filling me in, convincing me why I should finish it. You're not going to have to because I'm going to anyway. But since a lot of our listeners probably haven't, I'm assuming most people haven't finished it yet. So let's consider this like a recap of part two, like. You know, you're pitching it to somebody who hasn't finished it.
So part one was about how humans left Africa, spread out throughout the entire world, what the ancients knew about their world, and then how the world was reconnected into a globalized system. Those are two parts, really. The book has four parts. So part one is up to the ancients. Part two is how the world was connected into a globalized system with the age of exploration, also the Indian Ocean trade and China's age of exploration. Part three is how we became modern from a globalized system. So at the end of part two, the last thing that happened basically was Magellan circled the world, and then subsequently the Spanish built these outposts in Manila, and they brought goods from China to North America, and so it really thrust North America into this global system. So we have today food from all over the world. You go to a grocery store, you find food from China, from the Americas, from Europe, from Africa, anywhere you want, and it's just normal to us today, and that really is strange from the perspective of history. No time in the past have you ever had access to such a diverse food supply. This is really important from a lot of perspectives, including like ending famines. Basically, there are very few famines today. If there are, they're usually related to like a civil war or something like that, a food distribution problem. But the world produces way too much food. And one of the reasons is because we have access to the most diverse foods and the most productive foods, like potatoes, are from the Americas. And they were never existed in Europe before about 500 years ago. But once they brought them to Europe, they could have a different food supply from wheat. So even if the wheat crop failed, they had potatoes. Potatoes are the most productive, most calories per acre. And so basically the periodic famines that were killing people in Europe all the time ended because of potatoes.
Huh.
Right? And diseases spread throughout the world. Obviously the Native Americans were like devastated by disease. So yeah. This is one of the bad effects of the world being connected. But just the goods, even things like the influence of art on art was really important. The Dutch went out into the world and saw how the styles of China and India and basically copied them. And then that's how European art progressed and broke free of its stagnation. You have Vermeer painting like ideas from around the world and the invention of banking and economics. So that actually is part of... we're getting into part three now, which is modernity. So how we became modern.
Can we pause real quick before we get too far from potatoes?
Potatoes.
So potatoes. There was a bit in the book that I wanted to touch on, and you were just there with potatoes. And I just want to, I don't have much to say on it because you already like went to such great lengths in the book. But there was about 5 to 8 minutes on the audiobook that you spent talking about how potatoes wound up in, I believe it was Europe, as you were just talking about. Is that the part you spent, like, towards the middle of the book, there's, like, a whole bit where you're talking about all the different theories on how potatoes wound up in, I believe you were talking about Europe, could have been America, but you laid out all the possible theories that are out there for how potatoes wound up in this place, and my memory just is escaping me right now, but you went down into the detail of, like, how improbable it would be for a potato to have gotten to this new place by just floating across the ocean because it takes X amount of days for a potato to germinate and it would have done that in the ocean and like not made the journey or something. Like, I'm probably butchering this, but do you remember this part?
This is sweet potatoes, actually.
This is sweet potatoes. Okay.
Going to, which are not related. They're
not related.
Fairly different, actually. Yeah. Sweet potatoes crossed the ocean. And when Europeans arrived in the Pacific Islands in Polynesia, they found that the Polynesians were all sweet potato farmers. And they
breeded
them with sweet potatoes. And they thought, well, that's kind of strange. Sweet potatoes are from South America. How did they get here? And sweet potatoes, in fact, did not cross the ocean to the other side. They did not get to Africa. They did not get to Europe. They only got to places where humans could have carried them. They followed precisely the known movements of humans, except they somehow got from South America to Polynesia, which implies that Polynesians brought them from South America.
Right. And that so was the part.
It's one of the main clues for contact between Polynesia and South America. It's also possible that South Americans went in the other direction. This was the idea of Thor Heyerdahl, who built a raft and crossed the Pacific Ocean in a really what we would consider primitive raft. But evidence suggests that probably sweet potatoes were brought to the South Pacific by Polynesians who actually arrived in the Americas. There's sweet potatoes. There's another clue, which is coconuts, which started out in India. And the movement of coconuts corresponds to the known movements of seafarers. So they from India and Southeast Asia, they arrived in East Africa, brought by the Austronesian people who reached Madagascar. They reached West Africa, brought by Europeans in the 1500s. They did not reach Australia, which is quite close to Southeast Asia, but they did reach the Pacific coast of the Americas, which means they were probably brought there by Polynesians. Yeah.
So never before have I heard more information about sweet potatoes than in this book. And you made it so riveting. I was like, wow.
Sweet potatoes are, oh my gosh, I have a video called How the Sweet Potato Brought Down the Chinese Empire. Yeah. So
it made and brought it down.
Yeah, it made and destroyed the Chinese Empire. Yeah, so sweet potatoes are potatoes and sweet potatoes are two of the most nutritious and productive crops in the entire world. I mean, they grow well in poor conditions and bad soil. They're extremely nutritious, and they grow the most calories per acre, and they're pretty resilient as well. So, and they can be stored better than most crops as well. You put them in a cold cellar and they'll store for months. So sweet potatoes and potatoes are just amazing food crops. And when they came to China, by the way, is by far the leading producer of sweet potatoes, even though they originated in the Americas. So China didn't have them until the Europeans brought them in the 1600s. And when they were introduced, they were grown everywhere. And they caused actually eventually massive soil degradation because they were cutting down trees to plant sweet potatoes. And because they were so productive, though, you had this massive population explosion. But eventually, because they cut down all the trees, you had all this erosion, and it caused rebellions and famines and stuff. So basically, yeah, you could argue that sweet potatoes both created and destroyed the Chinese Empire. Well, not the original empire, but the Ming Dynasty.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. Okay, so I didn't want to derail you, but I did want to talk about the sweet potatoes because that was a part that stood out to me from the middle of the book. So you were going on to part three, I believe.
Well, honestly, food is one of the most important things in affecting humanity. I mean, an army marches on its stomach is the famous phrase, but it's true. And obviously, everything comes about as a result of food supply. That's where it all starts. We always talk totally. About agriculture, but it allows specialization. If you can create a surplus of food, it allows people to do other things like science and technology and develop tools and stuff like that. So food is the number one most important thing throughout human history, probably.
Definitely.
Yeah. So anyway, but the globalization of food is a super important topic. Going from part three, modernity, it basically takes us from how European empires went out to dominate global trade and the influences they brought back. So how the world was changing really rapidly in the 15 and 1600s because Europeans were exposing themselves to all kinds of ideas and they were developing like our economic system. They were developing banking and stock markets and insurance. All these economic concepts were invented to enable overseas trading voyages by the Dutch. And at one point in the 1600s, you have the Dutch controlling more ships probably than anyone else in the world, certainly by far the largest merchant marine, largest navy in the world. And this is a country that is half the size of Maine, and has 0.5% of the world's population. And for about 100 years, it completely dominated global trade. And
wow.
You had them in the East Indies, and you had, this is why New York was founded originally, and the South African colony, and basically why there's white people living in South Africa today traces back to that as well. So, And they brought back all kinds of ideas and not just so revolutionized almost everything we see today, economics, as I said, but even just like art and seeing the way the world was and inspired by different styles from China and Japan and India and Africa and the Americas. They created a lot of the ideas we see today, and it was really the Enlightenment. And I think this was super important. It went hand in hand with the scientific revolution, and a lot of that was taking place in the Netherlands as well. You've probably heard of Leeuwenhoek, who invented the microscope, and the Dutch also had the best like glass making in the world, telescopes and things like that. And so they were starting astronomy, like Huygens, Christian Huygens, like the great astronomer. So many fields of science were encouraged during this time, and the Dutch were super open-minded and really willing to experiment. And it was, I mean, so many of the technical marvels we see today really trace back to that time period when the Dutch were learning from the rest of the world. And obviously, in that chapter, I also talk about the downsides or the effects, like slavery and colonialism, which obviously, I mean, I think they're more a result of just human nature. They've happened throughout history. But obviously, the Europeans going out into the world made this far, far worse because they had access to bring people across the Atlantic and work them to death and as slaves and things like that. So that's like a horrible part of the legacy as well.
Right.
But yeah. So then I talk about continents. So Lewis Clark and just the search for the Northwest Passage and how, I mean, originally the Jamestown inhabitants and the people who were brought to the Americas were dumped off and told to either conquer the natives for gold, like the Spanish had done, or look for a way to get through the continent. So the people of Jamestown, the colonists of Jamestown, were supposed to like sail through the river systems to find a way to Asia still. They're still obsessed with getting to Asia. So, and this is the whole point of why the Europeans went into the world, is to try to access Asian markets, basically,
right,
to break into the thriving part of the trade network of the center of the world, which is Asia. And it's sort of the colonies that became states in the United States came about kind of accidentally, driven not by Europeans, but by the colonists themselves, who kind of said, well, I mean, we're living here now. We got to like do something with it, basically. So, but this is a really funny idea, because they assumed that there might be a passage of water through the continent, which is absolutely impossible, because by definition, rivers run only downhill. This is what makes rivers run, is gravity.
Ah, okay. Makes
rivers
sense.
Rivers always follow the closest gravitational gradient, the altitude gradient. So they always like float. They're literally just like water pouring downhill. Imagine like a hill, and you pour water at the top, and the water flows whichever path is the path of least resistance, basically. Yeah, whichever path is the least resistance. And that's what a river is. It's just water flowing downhill, right?
So it makes sense.
In the mountains, and it flows downhill. So these people who thought, you know, you could follow a river through the continent is ridiculous, because it's flowing downhill. Therefore, there must be a mountain in the way. Like, just by definition, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess you could like...
If only they had you.
Portage across the mountains, right? So, yeah. Anyway, and then, so that's how kind of the continents became opened up. And then we talk about how exploration evolved from sort of plunder and conquest and conquering the world and accessing the world's trade to scientific discovery. And this really happened during the 1700s, during the Age of Enlightenment, and the early 1800s, where explorers for the first time decided, you know, let's not really try to disrupt like the Native Americans and the indigenous people. Let's just try to learn from them, and let's try to learn about the world and conduct scientific experiments. And there were a number of French explorers who were giving precise instructions, like not to interact or not to interfere with like the natives and stuff like that, basically. And just like they set out on pure scientific voyages, right? Like one was to Ecuador to try to measure whether Earth bulges at the equator. At the top, by taking measurements at the top of a mountain, Chimborazo, which is the tallest mountain in the world, actually, if you measure it from the center of Earth, because Everest is not at the equator, but because Earth bulges at the equator, the tallest mountain from the center of Earth is actually in Ecuador. Mm. So they started renaming their ships in all kinds of like scientific names, like Discovery and Astrolabe and Adventurer and Resolution and Endeavor and stuff. So they kind of like people, you can tell what people's goals are by the way they name things.
Yeah.
Right. And so this kind of was an international arms race, kind of like the space race, but for scientific discovery. And James Cook is probably the best example of these explorers who set out just to fill in the map and just to figure out what's out there. And his famous phrase, "I had dreams to go not only as far as had been gone before, but as far as it was possible to go," is basically and that's what he wrote. It's basically exactly what they based Star Trek "To Boldly Go Where No One Has Gone Before."
Oh, yeah.
And James Cook of the ship Endeavor was the model for James Kirk of the Starship Enterprise.
Oh my gosh. Makes total sense.
Yeah, it's like almost exact copy.
No wonder Star Trek fans are always so smart, because they just get all these little references.
This was just people trying to learn about the world. And another really good example is Alexander von Humboldt, who went with permission from the Spanish authorities to study the wildlife and nature and geography and geology and hydrology and, everything. He studied the land in South America. Alexander von Humboldt, he was a super famous guy at the time, and people don't really know him nowadays. State of Nevada was almost named after him.
What a claim to fame. The second worst state in the country was almost named after this guy.
Is it the second worst?
I'm just spewing stuff that doesn't make any sense.
Oh, Nevada's pretty good. But so Alexander von Humboldt wrote about his discoveries and in a book that was supposed to be a natural history of the universe. And it was called Cosmos. Which you may recognize as being a show now by Neil deGrasse Tyson and originally Carl Sagan, but they based it on the original, which was by Alexander von Humboldt.
Interesting.
Which is talking about everything he learned by discovering the details of the science in the Americas. So, basically when Columbus and all those early European explorers and conquistadors came over, they just kind of trampled over the natives and stole their gold and established these kind of empires, but they didn't really care about the details. So it took this second wave of scientific explorers to really fill in and understand what was actually there. I mean, so it's kind of like a micro exploration, not just like, well, making more detailed maps for sure, but not just kind of like going there, but really studying the place, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there were, so really understanding it and learning a lot about the world. And then this also, at the same time, there was a woman named Ida Pfeiffer who was the first like scientific travel writer. So she went around the world and went to different kingdoms and different countries and wrote about her travels, and it kind of encouraged other people to go. So she's kind of the founder of global tourism. This is the reason why people love taking trips around the world now. She was the first person to do this. It's kind of just for fun, right?
Yeah, because back then it was so dangerous. Like, who in their right mind would just go travel?
Get on a boat. Had a pistol and stuff like that. And,
yeah,
you know, one
totally.
Time she was almost eaten by cannibals and she was attacked with a knife. The world was pretty dangerous back then.
Before we get too far from this,
especially for a lone woman.
Yeah, that's so crazy. Before we get too far from this, like, early science stage of exploration, I just want to kind of touch on something that's slightly unrelated, but it does kind of dovetail back in. It's just like, you hear about early scientific discoveries and you hear about the front runners of early science and how a lot of them were devoutly religious. And this is like an argument that gets raised in religious debates all the time. Like, oh, well, like the first scientists were, Roman Catholic or whatever. And, I just think it's just interesting when you think about it in terms of what people knew at this stage and what they were actually after. People weren't, their religion aside, they weren't out to explore the world for their religion. I would say that it's probably the other way around. These people were religious almost by default, just because that's what like pretty much everybody in a modern society was. And their curiosity was what fueled their explorations. Like they wanted to know more about this place and like how to, use it to our advantage and how to make society better. And so it wasn't, I just feel like a lot of times you hear people say like, well, the early science, front runners were people just like trying to improve their religion or something. And I just feel like that's not accurate at all. These people were out to explore and to figure out how to, survive better and to make life better.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think that you hit the nail on the head with saying basically it's kind of in spite of being religious rather than because they were religious. I mean, not, yeah. I mean, it might fill them with some kind of passion or something like that. So these two things definitely are not mutually exclusive. They can be if you take them to the extreme, but in general, they don't have to be. Darwin, for example, had originally trained to be a priest, and he was going to go to seminary school. But that's, you're right, that's just because that was the job opportunity that was available to him, right? So there are a few examples of scientific people who were not religious, even a long time ago, like Spinoza is a philosopher, I think from around the 1500s, Netherlands, Jewish actually, originally, I guess, but he was secular and he kind of described God as like the universe, the universal force, right? But not anything, like not a personal God. And that's Einstein specifically, I think, said he subscribed to Spinoza's God,
What is his first name?
Possibly Erasmus? I'm not actually entirely sure.
Erasmus?
Yeah. Erasmus? Erasmus?
Erasmus.
I'm not sure if that's true, but Spinoza.
I want to know more about Spinoza. That guy sounds interesting.
Yeah, he's kind of the earliest secular humanist who really wrote about it that we know of. I mean, well, that's not really true because the Greeks, the ancient Greeks who were really at the height of the ancient world knowledge were all basically secular. I mean, theoretically, they believed in Zeus and
they were polytheistic. Jupiter, Apollo, they were like advanced polytheism.
I guess that's Jupiter is the Roman one. But yeah, exactly. But again, it's questionable how much people believed those things. I'm sure some did, and some kind of thought they were stories, right? Like probably it's questionable whether with these polytheistic things, whether you just, it was very much it was less organized with the polytheism. So you could, if you wanted to like pray to Athena or something like that, you could, but it's not like, I mean, there was a temple of Athena, but it's kind of like,
it's mythology.
Not as like organized, right? Yeah, it was kind of mythology. I wonder how much it was to them too. I may think it varied by person, but yeah, to them it was probably a bit of stories as well.
When you read that Greek literature, it's like you know, those stories. You could tell how, you know, stories were so powerful. They've always been powerful. Stories have always been really powerful, and you can kind of see similarities between the way Jesus put, you know, moral tales into parables, and the way, you know, there's obviously a stark difference. There's a stark difference because Jesus's parables were like little short skits, if you will, and like the Greek stories are like, you know, chapters long, like actually kind of a lot more like you see in like the Old Testament and the Bible, like longer passages and things like that. But point being that it's arguable and it's easy to imagine that the Greeks would have thought that that mythology was just very clearly like a parable or a fable or something like that. We're going to take a quick break, but don't go anywhere. We're coming right back. I promise. I mean, it's a lot of it's so extreme too. It's like, it's way more extreme than the Old Testament even. Like, I don't see how they could think this stuff was real.
Like Athena was born out of Zeus's head, just possibly formed.
It's like what? It makes Scientology look normal.
Yeah. I don't know if people really believed a lot of the stuff, but yeah.
Maybe they did. Maybe there were some zealots.
There definitely were zealots. There was like people who devoted themselves to it, priests and stuff like that. But it's hard to understand what the difference might have been, but it might have been a little bit more like sort of stories. Like actually, it's kind of probably similar to Hinduism, right? Today, which is polytheistic and has stories and gods that do things. And there are definitely very devout Hindus who kind of literally believe Hinduism is the literal truth. But how many Hindus kind of think those are useful ways of thinking or useful story? I mean, it's kind of like Christianity today. A lot of people don't really believe in the literal truth of the Bible either. And it's just kind of useful stories or something like that, right? So, yeah. But I think maybe polytheism maybe has more of a tendency to these things are useful stories and they're part of our culture rather than, you know, this is a blueprint for everything in life.
Yeah, it would kind of maybe fall... it seems like it would lend itself more to like cultural memory than like what they perceived as history or something like that.
Yeah, maybe. I think originally they were intended to be histories. Especially with Hinduism, you get the sense. I mean, it's kind of telling the story of how the world was created. So, I think that kind of was intended to be history as a story, but not necessarily total guidance for everything in life.
It's also hard to imagine, you know, this is a conversation I found myself in, you know, pertaining to the Old Testament too, but you can also, it's easy to imagine that people this long ago, knowing as little as they did about the world. I mean, we're sitting here devoting a whole episode to, you know, this is the second whole episode we've devoted to your book on exploration and what we knew when and how. And all of these books we're talking about were written before a lot of this exploration happened. And so they really didn't know that much, you know? And so point being, it's hard for us to imagine what the common idea of history would have been to these people. Like, what slot would they have for organized history, like a timeline of events that were factual? Like, maybe they wouldn't even have a slot for that, you know? I don't know.
Some people did, some people didn't. I mean, history was basically invented by Eratosthenes. We talked about last time about the dating system. He invented everything, though. So
he's the man. Geography too. But, I love Eratosthenes.
He invented the dating system dating back to year zero as Troy, the Battle of Troy. So presumably before the Battle of Troy, things happened. I guess he just thought anything before Troy was a long time ago and not worth including in our calendar. But yeah.
Yeah. But if you look at, like, and we're kind of deviating a little bit from exploration, but looking at the way that, you know, the similarities between the, like, Greek mythology and the Old Testament stories that are really out there, like the parting of the Red Sea, the Garden of Eden, this talking snake, and then, like, you know, the examples you brought about the Greek mythology, about the birth from that guy's head and things like that. It's like, people, you know, might have, surely they thought this was applicable in some way and worth writing down, clearly, because we're still talking about it today. But, you know, this is much, much different. Like, all of these writings, they came from different cultures at different times, roughly around the same era, but they all kind of, you know, they have this distinct writing style that is much, much different than what you and I would consider historically relevant today. You know, something that is, like, worth labeling as, quote, history. Like, we would, nobody today would look at these old books and be like, this is history. But yeah, maybe these people back then did. But again, what does that say about what they thought history was, or what the purpose of it was? You know, it's just, I don't know. It's just interesting to think about.
Yeah, I think sort of our obsession, rightly so, I think, you know, obsession with facts is a good thing. But I think maybe in the past, people were much more willing to mix fact and fiction, and it kind of blended into this thing that doesn't matter if it's real or not. I don't know. Maybe that's a modern conceit to think that way. That
I think maybe the Red Sea parted and a bunch of people walked through.
The other thing is they just didn't know things. They didn't know how the world worked. They didn't know that it wasn't really possible to have the Red Sea part, except I think it actually is. There's an explanation for that. But anyway.
Yeah.
But before, but history, actually, Eratosthenes didn't really invent history. I think it was more, people would more say it was like Herodotus, which I think came before. But he was the first one to really systematize things and try to establish what's true and what's not true, and try to have history be a separate discipline from mythology, right? Because it's kind of like how astronomy used to be the same, intermixed with astrology, and now they're very separate, right? And now astrology is like predicting your horoscope based on the position of the stars and planets, and astronomy is trying to separate out all the stuff that's not true from the stuff that is true, and it's a science. And history is a type of science, basically, and it's trying to establish what is true and what's not true. So it's kind of a more modern idea to try to separate what's true from what's not true, and rather than just have them jumbled together.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess the whole point of that rabbit trail was just like thinking about the way that we categorize, you know, facts today versus how people would have done it back then. And, you know, specifically as that relates to these early scientific pioneers, and whether or not they were religious, and whether or not that's a valid point in a discussion about what the origin of what science was created for, what the intent was. You know, like, you can't say that because the original scientists were Roman Catholic that therefore science is here to benefit Roman Catholicism. Like, it makes no sense. It's like facts, either benefit our everyday life and our understanding of things in a way that improves our lives, or they don't.
Yeah. Well, science should be universal and not related to any religion, either in its founding or in its application.
Right.
I mean,
so we should move on from this point forever. and get back on track to your book. We've explored off the trail enough. It was an interesting venture.
Yeah. So taking off on the scientific voyages of exploration, then we end up with the kind of adventurous exploration, which kind of served not really any economic purpose, unlike a lot of the previous explorations, but was just a drive of human willpower, which is the exploration of the Arctic and the Antarctic, which happened mostly in our century, or actually the previous century. I guess we're in the 21st century now.
I guess so.
Mostly, yeah.
Look at the time.
Yeah, exactly. Boy, it's been 19 years and I didn't notice. It's funny. I almost, yeah. Do you consider yourself a product of the 20th century or the 21st? Even if you're...
Yeah, I don't know. I consider myself a product of 20th century Fox.
Yeah.
Bum, ba, da, bum, so, ba, 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 bum.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, so mostly happened in the 20th century, early 20th century. So how people reach the Arctic for the first time, like, what is the point of reaching the North Pole? I don't know, but people wanted to do it. I mean, the point was just to say you did it.
They wanted to see if Santa was there.
Yeah, right. I don't actually, that's interesting. The Santa comes from the Dutch, too. We were talking about...
Oh, God, now you're going to prove
culture.
It right.
Sinterklaas is Dutch New York culture lampoon. That's the fat guy in the sailor suit is basically what the British were making fun of the Dutch in New York.
I got to stop cracking jokes with you. You prove them all correct.
And trying to reach the South Pole as well. So these are just battles of human spirit and endurance, right? And it was just really difficult. And a lot of people died trying to reach the North and the South Pole, which seems to us kind of... I mean, it's kind of like climbing Mount Everest, right? Just for a good selfie, basically. Like, what's the point?
Yeah.
Like, but it's because it's there. I mean, that's what the famous, I think, Edmund Hillary said when he was asked, why did you climb Mount Everest? Because it's there. Because, you know, humans just like challenges, right? And I think this relates to how... challenge is really important for us as a civilization, as a society. It's what drives our technology. It's what causes us to solve problems. The whole point of the book is that technology follows purpose. So you set a purpose first,
right.
You decide on a goal, and then you figure out how to do it. And in figuring out how to do it, you solve all kinds of other problems that you didn't even know existed. It's just that setting difficult challenges for ourselves to accomplish is really important. And it's really important for individuals. Like, I'm going to go to the gym and do this extra work. But when you kind of set a goal, it motivates you to accomplish something. And it's really important. Anyway, so I think that's really why the exploration of the Arctic and Antarctic happened. And now, you know, of course, submarines can surface at the North Pole. And we sort of conquered the Arctic. And with the global temperatures rising, there's now ice-free passages through the Northwest Passage for the first time. So it's kind of...
There's a silver lining.
Explorers. Yeah, I mean, it is sort of... Container ships can now go between China and Europe much faster than they ever could before across the North Pole. So not the pole exactly, but the Northwest Passage. Yeah. So creating much more than greenhouse gases, but I guess less than they would by taking a longer route. But yeah.
Yeah, well, maybe they'll reverse the effects to the point where the ice grows back and then they can't do it anymore.
Yeah.
And then we'll just keep going back and forth.
And then I get into airplanes. So the book follows an upward kind of trajectory. So we've done all the kind of exploration on Earth, basically,
yeah.
And then development of airplanes. And this is one of the...
We're in a modern technology now.
We're in a modern technology now, and how airplanes went from dangerous stunt craft flown by daredevils who crashed regularly and died, like almost all the early airplane... pioneers crashed multiple times. I think all of the army planes ordered from the Wright brothers, they all crashed within a year.
Crazy.
So, I mean, planes were just crashing all the time, right? Like
the wrong brothers.
Louis Blériot, who flew across the English Channel for the first time, had crashed two airplanes previously. And in World War I, more pilots were killed just by crashes than enemy action. So they were just like, the planes were just dangerous and they just crashed. Right. And they weren't even given parachutes because it was considered that they would abandon their aircraft too easily. So parachutes had been invented, and parachutes were issued to balloonists in the First World War. There was actually a lot of balloons used over the trenches because you take a balloon high up and then see what the opposing trenches look like. But the balloons were filled with hydrogen, so they were vulnerable to any attack, and people would shoot at them and they'd catch on fire. So people would have parachutes in the balloons and they'd parachute out of the balloons as soon as their balloon was shot at and caught on fire.
Right? They had a balloon for their balloon.
They had a parachute for the balloon. But airplane pilots were not issued parachutes because then people were like, well, they're just going to jump out of their plane. Like, we don't want that. That's an expensive airplane.
I was just going to say, it's the expense of the airplane, probably.
It is, totally. Yeah.
That's so messed up. Yeah. This thing costs too much. Let's not give them a parachute.
Exactly. Well, it's also dubious whether, like, it might have been safer. People had this idea that they were going to try to ride the airplane down to the ground. So even if your plane was damaged, you might try to, like, fly it down to a crash landing where you'd safely emerge, which I guess sometimes happened, but still, yeah, it's a little dubious.
That is insane.
Anyway, they changed that for the Second World War, where they definitely were given parachutes, but yeah.
Somehow I just want to orient the listeners. Somehow we're going to get from, the book starts at with the evolution of, Australopithecus, arguably, and then it goes all the way through agriculture and early complex society. And now, right now we're at like early modern technology, and we're going to get to, intergalactic colonization. So we still got a bit to go. But I just wanted to let people know where we're going.
Yeah, I think we should do another one on the space stuff because there's going to be a lot of futuristic stuff that you're going to want to poke at too. So we should do another one on the fourth part. But we'll finish the third part here, which is...
Okay, that's a good idea.
Pretty close to wrapping up. So that's a good idea. So aviation went from this dangerous profession based on the incremental achievements of pioneers like Amelia Earhart. So the aviation chapter, I focus a lot on Amelia Earhart, which I wanted to include some women, but she's actually really fascinating too, which I didn't know that much about her. And she was an engineering professor. She founded the first airline, TWA, and was an aerospace engineer designing her own planes as well as flying them. So really inspiring figure. Yeah. Anyway, but there's some controversy over where she was. She basically crashed in the Pacific. That's what she's kind of famous for, I guess. And there's some controversy over exactly what happened. Did she crash at sea, just run out of fuel? Or did she crash land on an island, Gardner Island, possibly, because they found some artifacts, maybe? So it's unclear what happened to her. And I find it kind of interesting that the fact that we can't confirm or deny a plane crashed in the 1930s on an island really provides, I think, a lot of insight for trying to identify archaeological artifacts about the Vikings, about what the Vikings did, because that was like 1,000 years ago. And we're talking about 80 years ago. We can't tell whether an airplane crashed or not. I mean, what it means is that sometimes evidence for things doesn't last very long, and it's difficult to disentangle from other evidence. So it's hard to say whether Amelia Earhart, exactly what happened to her. Therefore, it's also hard to say exactly what happened to the Vikings because the evidence would have been destroyed so much longer ago.
I'm confused. Yeah. Are you saying that I know you're not saying this is a conspiracy, but it sounds like that's what you're saying. I know it's not a conspiracy. I know that's not what you're suggesting because you're totally against conspiracy theories, but I'm not sure what you're getting at with this whole evidence doesn't last that long argument and how you're comparing it to the Vikings.
I'm not saying it's a conspiracy. What I'm saying is we don't really know what happened. It's a mystery. And because there's a mystery surrounding what happened to a 20th century aviator and the evidence around that, like there's not enough evidence to conclusively say one way or the other what happened to her. A conspiracy would be like if we knew what happened, or we thought we knew what happened to her, but the evidence doesn't really support it.
Right.
But
I know that's not what you're saying. I'm just a little lost.
We just don't really even know what happened, right? And the fact that we don't know what happened, given that it was only like 80 years ago with an airplane and people were looking for it just a few years or actually right after the event, what that means is the evidence wasn't enough to determine what happened.
Couldn't it just be that when she crashed, there was like a big explosion that destroyed all the evidence or something like that?
Well, if there was a big explosion, yeah, it might have caught on fire or something like that. Although I think, she was basically out of fuel. But even if it did, there'd still be charred remains and there'd be metal, scrap metal and stuff like that. I mean, you'd have lots of evidence of a plane crash, right?
What about at the bottom of the ocean?
Well, yeah. So she crashed in the ocean. But the thing is, people think that she might have crashed on this island. And the fact that we can't confirm or deny she might have crashed on this island is a little bit strange.
Yeah. So how does this relate to the Vikings? I'm confused about that.
Well, what it means is there's not enough evidence to determine what happened to Amelia Earhart, something that was relatively recent with modern technology that should be easy to identify. We don't know exactly how far the Vikings got in the Americas. We do know only one settlement in Newfoundland, but they might have gotten a lot further, right, into New England and founded other settlements. There might be a bunch of other settlements that were later abandoned, but have not been discovered. But the reason we may not have discovered them is because the evidence might have been wiped out, right? Just like with Amelia Earhart, the evidence didn't really last or wasn't enough to determine one way or the other. Therefore, looking for evidence of former Viking settlements might actually be really difficult because there's been 1,000 years for other things to come along, to the evidence to get kind of buried and stuff like that. What I'm saying is there are so many clues from the ancient world, so many pieces of evidence from the ancient world that we don't even have because it's been lost.
Mm-hmm. So you're bringing up the Vikings in relation to Amelia Earhart to kind of just as like a, you're saying that those two cases have that in common that we'll probably never know.
Yeah, exactly. We'll probably never know. We don't know the full extent of what the Vikings did in North America. That's a mystery. And we probably don't have enough evidence to say one way or the other, and probably never will, because the evidence has been lost or destroyed and not like a conspiracy destroyed, just destroyed by the elements, by the weather, by people coming along and building a farm on the ground, right? It's just not there anymore for whatever reason, accidentally. And it's interesting, though, that we just won't probably ever have the evidence to say exactly what happened.
Yeah, that is, it's frustrating. It's frustrating.
Anyway, and the last part goes into the space race. So why we went to the moon and how we explore space with robots. There's a chapter on robotic exploration of the solar system. So that brings us right up to modern times with the space race. So the interesting thing about the space race is obviously it was a Cold War contest between the United States and the Soviet Union. And the fact that the Soviet Union won the first part of the race with Sputnik and with Yuri Gagarin meant that the United States was motivated to go to the moon to try to win the Cold War, basically.
Right.
And all of that, I mean, the Sputnik and Yuri Gagarin really happened just because of the Cold War superpower race and the fact that the United States had air superiority, so it had much better air force, and the Soviet Union was far away. So to counter the threat of the U.S. Air Force being able to drop bombs on the Soviet Union, nuclear bombs, basically, the Soviet Union needed to develop ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles. So it was a way that the Soviets could counter U.S. air superiority. And Korolev, who was the head of the Soviet space program, wanted to go to the moon and to Mars, just like Wernher von Braun, but he could only find work for the military. But because they developed this capability to have ballistic missiles, they thought, well, wouldn't it be interesting? We might as well just try a stunt where we put a satellite on this thing, right? To demonstrate it to the world. And so they did. And what that meant with Sputnik flying overhead is it was simultaneously inspirational and terrorizing. So it's like, oh my gosh, there's like this.
Oh, look at this incredibly terrifying thing.
With his bomb. But isn't that kind of cool?
Yeah.
People put them, Americans put them on their Christmas tree. Getting back to you. Getting back to the start of the conversation.
That's the ultimate intimidation. People putting this this weapon of mass destruction on the top of their holiday ornament, on the holiday symbols, their Christmas trees. That is really funny. I think this is probably a good place to wrap this up if we're going to devote a whole third episode to the space stuff, which I think is a good idea because you're right, I am going to have a lot of questions about that. And we had no shortage of side adventures here on this one. So let's make a part 3. for the space section of your book. And why don't you just give us like an idea of where we're heading with that space, the space stuff, like where it winds up, like where it lands. You don't have to give any spoilers, obviously, but if you just want to kind of give us a teaser of where we're going in the next one.
That's the final chapter, the ultimate destination. Actually, what's the far future for humanity? Are we going to upload ourselves into computers? Is this a simulated universe? That kind of stuff. So you'll like that. Are we going to live forever? Are we going to mutate ourselves? All this kind of stuff. So, yeah. But basically the chapter or the part, which is six chapters, is about why we should go to space in general, why Mars is the best place to go, expansion into the solar system, which is a necessary precondition for going to other stars. And then could we ever get to other stars? And then what are aliens like? Are there aliens? What are they like? What would they be like? And then the ultimate destination, meaning what is the eventual fate of humanity?
This is the part of the book I'm most excited to get to. And I'm going to try to get through the final third of the book before we do this, because the reason I'm so excited is because obviously this is your day-to-day challenges as with space stuff, since that's what you do for your day job. So I think that's probably, if I had to guess, this is probably your most popular part of the book, the part you hear the most about. Is that right?
I think that's true. Yeah. It probably is the most popular. It's called Becoming Star Trek and how we could actually.
Of course it is.
Star Trek.
Of course it is. I just want to know, is there a Baby Yoda in it anywhere? Because Baby Yoda is hella cute.
Man, I just found out about Baby Yoda too late. Otherwise, I definitely would have included Baby Yoda.
Baby Yoda is adorable.
Exactly, but, yeah.
Baby Yoda looks just like my son,
there's a
Hugo.
Will, there's a way. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this has been fun. I hope you guys enjoyed it. This is part 2 of 3 of Beyond the Known, How Exploration Created the Modern World and Will Take Us to the Stars by Andrew Rader. I hope the book is doing well. I know you don't know, it's too early, but I'm wishing you all the best with it, Andrew. And to the rest of you, if you want to follow us on Twitter, I'm at Julian Was Here. Andrew is at Mars Raider. We do these every Monday, and we hope you're back next week.
Thanks for listening. If you want to check out the book, there's an audiobook, and there's also, obviously, it's available everywhere. But if you want to give the book a review on Amazon, that's really important. So please do that if you want to help.
I also just want to say, since you brought up the audiobook, I forgot to say this earlier. It is the most frustrating thing for me listening to your audiobook, because I'm so used to hearing you in my headphones and being able to like comment on things that you're saying and ask questions. And then I can't do that with the audiobook. So I've been like, whenever I listen to it, I'm just like, damn it.
So
this is like simultaneously riveting and frustrating as hell. But I'm loving it. Gotta check out the audiobook. That's an endorsement, not a diss. It's an endorsement.